This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heeb. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
three gendarmes have been killed this week by suspected separatists in Cameroon's northwest region. The violence represents a marked escalation as the unrest in Cameroon's two Anglophone regions nears the one-year mark.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzaka reporting from Yaoundé. Full details on the story coming up.
Also, political analysts say the ouster of his longtime ally now clears the way for Mugabe to appoint his wife, Grace Mugabe, as vice president. And Ugandan legislators want the government to ensure the human rights of workers who leave home to work under difficult conditions in the Middle East.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe says he fired Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa because he was plotting to take power. Mugabe's comments came in a speech to a cheering crowd of ZANU-PF party loyalists today. Mnangagwa served with Mugabe since he led the effort to end British colonialism in 1980. He has reportedly fled the country, but exactly where he went isn't clear. Political analysts say the ouster of his longtime ally now clears the way for Mugabe to appoint his wife, Grace Mugabe, as vice president. That would put her in a strong position to eventually replace the 93-year-old president. Several party groups have backed her appointment. Mnangagwa issued a statement vowing to return to Zimbabwe to lead party members. He said that Mugabe must understand ZANU-PF is not his personal property. Despite his age, Mugabe, the world's oldest head of state, is expected to run for re-election next year. For more on this story, I spoke with VOA South Africa correspondent Anita Powell in Johannesburg.
Hi.
Anita, what do you have on regarding President Mugabe appointing his wife at this point as vice president?
Well, I just want to stress that no decision will be actually made officially until ZANU-PF holds its party conference in about mid-December. It starts on December 12th. So right now, while there seems to be every indication that the president does support his wife, that he does want her to take the position, it's not over until ZANU-PF gets together and issues that statement, and that probably won't come for a little while.
What has been reaction to his intentions?
Well, that's a great question. Here in Johannesburg today, the head of the Zimbabwe War Veterans Association summoned journalists and said that they are fighting mad over this, not so fighting mad that they would ever consider a coup, but fighting mad enough that they're going to put up a slate with the deposed vice president at the head of it to contest the election in 2018, which, as you know, Mr. Mugabe is going to be running in.
Okay, and also, what does Mnangagwa and the ZANU-PF party, what does he intend on doing if Grace Mugabe does become vice president?
That's a great question. Mnangagwa put out a long statement today basically saying that he remains loyal to the ZANU-PF. But he made a very key distinction there. He does not remain loyal, he says, although he has been loyal to Mr. Mugabe his entire career. He wants to restore the integrity of the ZANU-PF. So one can read from that statement that he intends to put up a challenge to ZANU-PF. He will return to Zimbabwe, and he will challenge them. But as he said, he's given every indication that he's going to do it in a democratic, transparent sort of manner.
That was our colleague Anita Powell speaking with me from Johannesburg.
Three gendarmes have been killed this week by suspected separatists in Cameroon's northwest region. The violence represents a marked escalation as the unrest in Cameroon's two Anglophone regions nears the one-year mark. Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government spokesperson, Issa Chiruma, says two gendarmes were attacked and killed by armed men late Tuesday in the northwestern town of Bamenda. The killings came barely 24 hours after another gendarme was shot dead in the town of Jakiri, also in the northwest. Chiruma said armed men who had attacked a school in Jakiri to chase out the children seized the gendarme's gun and used it to kill him.
The persistence of these acts of violence has become incomprehensible and hides the maneuvers of some people who cheerfully manipulate the population and especially the youths in support of a hidden agenda. Emergency measures have been taken in order to arrest the breakers, identify and search out their sponsors and accomplices.
Four schools as well as shops in Bamenda were burned last week. No one has claimed responsibility for any of the attacks. On social media, activists have threatened schools and businesses in Cameroon's two Anglophone regions that fail to observe calls to strike. There have been numerous arson attacks on schools and markets since the start of this year. However, some parents, like this father, Innocent Ekale, are defying calls to keep their children home.
There is no need striking and making children to stay in the house because that's like killing a whole generation.
The government reports that more than 40% of students have resumed classes in the major urban areas of the northwest and the southwest. Schools remained closed in villages where residents complain of mounting insecurity. The residents blame both separatist groups and soldiers. The crisis began in November of last year when English-speaking lawyers and teachers went on strike, demanding reforms to address the overbearing use of French in the bilingual country. Tensions quickly intensified as Anglophone separatist groups joined the movement, sparking a government crackdown and dozens of arrests. Large pro-independence demonstrations on October 1st left dozens dead and over 100 injured. Government attempts to hold dialogue in the English-speaking regions last month made little headway. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In the Gambia, human rights activists are bracing up for a major event today. Vice President Fatoumata Tamba Jang Jallo was meeting with the victims of former President Yahya Jammeh. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
The vice president is the third government official to visit Jammeh's victims. The government has reaffirmed its commitment to bringing Mr. Jammeh and his accomplices to face justice. Some of the soldiers linked to human rights abuses against Gambians have been taken into custody while others have fled the country. Dr. Amur Sakriet Jane works with the organization called Gambia Center for Victims of Human Rights Violations.
Well, the objective of the meeting is to exchange ideas with the government and also to give an opportunity for victims to air any grievances, any concerns they may have to the vice president.
The vice president's visit is aimed at giving hope to the victims of the former dictator's misrule, many of whom are yearning for justice. Mr. Jammeh is living in exile in Equatorial Guinea. He has ruled the Gambia for over 22 years with an iron fist.
The stories from victims are very compelling indeed. We have folks whose parents were simply disappeared, stories about torture, about execution, or extrajudicial killing, folks who experienced electric shocks, even people whose genitals were subjected to inhumane treatment.
The government of President Adama Barrow has set up a truth, reconciliation, and reparation commission with the hope of healing the past wounds. The commission will also work to promote reconciliation in the country. Extraditing Jammeh to Banjul to face justice remains a daunting challenge, according to Amadou Jane.
Not going to be very easy. We don't expect it to happen overnight, but we are determined to work toward it. We're very determined, and we've learned lessons from the Habre experience in Senegal, his trial in Senegal, the former Chadian dictator. And with the support that we have from our fellow victims and the international community and somebody like Reed Brody, we expect to get Jammeh and his associates in a much shorter period of time.
Reed Brody is a human rights lawyer with the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. He recently flew to the Gambia to meet with Jammeh's victims. Mr. Brody is optimistic about Jammeh having his day in court.
Yahya Jammeh went to Equatorial Guinea, where he believed was a very safe place because there's a dictator there. But I think that once you hear the stories, you hear the story of Nana Jo Ndaw, whose father was disappeared. You hear the story of Amadou Scatra Jane, who was thrown in jail for making democracy t-shirts and is now fighting for justice. You hear the story of Fatoumata Sangneng. You hear the horrible torture that Imam Babalé went through. When people hear those stories, they say, you know something? These people deserve justice.
Dictator Yahya Jammeh seized power in July of 1994 after toppling the democratically elected government of former Gambian President Sadao Dakairaba Jawara. His presidency came to an end in December of 2016 when Gambians voted against Mr. Jammeh to elect President Adama Barrow, a former real estate developer. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
Election controversies in Kenya and Liberia have raised concerns over the health of their democracies. Kenya's Supreme Court nullified its August presidential election, pointing to irregularities and illegalities. The opposition boycotted last month's rerun, which incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta won, but now there are new court challenges. In Liberia, the Supreme Court cancelled this week's runoff election between the former soccer star George Weah and Vice President Joseph Boakai. While officials investigate claims of fraud in the first round vote, VOA's Adam Phillips reports on what these controversies might mean for the state of democracy in Africa overall.
Ambassador John Campbell, an Africa expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, says the election controversies in Liberia and Kenya mirror each other in crucial ways.
What you have in both cases is an affirmation and behavior of the judiciary, a judiciary that is independent. And what that does is it promotes the rule of law. And the rule of law, it seems to me, is absolutely crucial for democracy.
But Campbell also notes that if there are perceptions that the rule of law has been compromised, that can be seen as a failure of democracy.
In the case of Kenya, this raises all kinds of questions about the legitimacy of the new government, or rather perceptions of its legitimacy. Too soon to say whether there's going to be a similar parallel in Liberia.
Jason Stearns analyzes African politics at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. He says concern over the elections in Kenya and Liberia and Africa's democracies overall contrasts with the optimism many felt during the 1990s.
Kenya became democratic in the 1990s. You had Nigeria. And, of course, South Africa transitioned from apartheid rule to multi-party democracy and black majority rule. All of these things came with an enormous optimism. Back in the day, Bill Clinton in particular hailed the arrival at power of visionary rebel leaders in Ethiopia, Eritrea, Rwanda, and Uganda. Now, every single one of those countries just mentioned, these have failed to give up power and hand the power over to the opposition.
Stearns says the tilt toward democracy in the 1990s was partly an illusion. In his view, the outward signs of democracy were in place, but not its inner substance.
You had multi-party elections in many places, but underneath those multi-party elections, the fundaments of power, the bedrock of power, remained roughly the same, which was power was controlled by a very small sliver of elites, and that it was managed through a mixture of coercion and corruption.
In Stern's judgment, much of Africa's current unrest is an attempt by the vast majority of the population to challenge the system.
And say, hey, wait a second, this isn't serving us. This isn't serving what we want to happen. And so that certainly is the case for Kenya. That's the case in the Democratic Republic of the Congo today, where the president has tried to extend or has now overstayed his term in office, and you have youth movements bubbling up. In Burundi, it's the same thing. And so across the continent, you see new social movements, new dynamics popping up with people contesting the status quo.
Ambassador John Campbell is concerned that, in Kenya at least, the impasse may have more to do with ethnic tensions than class conflict. The incumbent, Uhuru Kenyatta, is from the Kikuyu group, the nation's largest ethnic group. His chief opponent, Raila Odinga, is from the Luo ethnic group.
And these two particular ethnic groups have been rivals for a long time. So what you've got is the possibility that a personal rivalry between Kenyatta and Odinga will spiral out of control and become essentially an ethnic conflict. I worry a good deal about that.
Still, there have been democratic success stories in recent years. They include Senegal's 2015 election, in which the opposition won the presidency and everybody accepted the results. In Nigeria the same year, opposition leader Muhammadu Buhari defeated the incumbent Goodluck Jonathan. And in South Africa, constitutional institutions put in place in 1997 have proved sturdy. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Ugandan legislators want the government to ensure the human rights of workers who leave home to work under difficult conditions in the Middle East. The call follows the release of a list from Uganda's embassy in Abu Dhabi showing likely abuse. It shows that 48 Ugandans have died from the United Arab Emirates and neighboring countries where they went in search for employment. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
The biting poverty and unemployment, especially among the youths in Uganda, has driven many to seek jobs abroad, especially in the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, and other countries of the Middle East. A new report compiled by Uganda Parliament Committees of Labour and Foreign Affairs indicates that between January and 31st August this year, nearly 50 Ugandans have died in Oman, Bahrain, and Kuwait. According to the report, the majority of them committed suicide. David Abala is one of the legislators on the Parliamentary Gender Committee.
You become the property of your boss. Not that you might be a property. Can you imagine 35 of them committing suicide? One person died because of cardiac arrest. You know, these are some of the things that come as a result of tension all the time. And then the other one is septic shocks. You can imagine, this is, there are two women who perish because of this. When you have a heart attack, forget, you know this, what this one means. These are the problems that we have. That's why we are saying a liver failure. Then there's one saying that somebody died because of drowning. How do you drown in a desert?
Moses Binoga is the coordinator of Uganda's anti-human trafficking task force. He says most of those who have died go to the countries illegally without government knowledge and aren't monitored.
Unlicensed people are continuing to hoodwink Ugandans and recruit them. When they don't have licenses, they don't have any concern about them. And most of them, when they reach outside there, they are suffering without having any way of being assisted. Most of them, when the jobs they are promised, they don't get them. And they are forced, some of them, into prostitution.
Margaret Komhanji, another legislator, agrees that indeed they found many girls living illegally in the countries.
We found so many in homestead. They are being mistreated, others were rotting, but government didn't know about because they were illegal immigrants. They had not registered with the country. They had not gone through their immigration.
There have been a number of calls on Parliament to ban illegal labor to the Middle East. However, Parliament argues that Ugandans are free to seek employment anywhere. They instead want government to sign binding agreements with countries where Ugandans are employed for better tracking. Rebecca Kadaga is the Speaker of Uganda's Parliament.
Sometimes people are saying, don't allow Ugandans to go. How would you stop them? How would you stop a Ugandan from leaving the country to go to look for opportunities? You can't. This is a globalized world. They don't even tell you where they are going. You just hear that they are there. So we told the minister first to try and identify all the countries where people go and try and get into agreements, proper agreements with the government, so that they have a certain amount of protection. So Malaysia, we don't have agreements.
The legislators have threatened that if the agreements are not signed, they intend to introduce a motion to stop export of labor to the Middle East countries. Mwine Mpaka is a representative of the youth in Uganda Parliament.
So we have the view that for all those countries that do not have bilateral agreements with us, we stop exportation of these young boys and girls to these countries so that we can safeguard our young boys and girls to go and work in conducive environments just like other countries like the Philippines are doing.
Agnes Igoye is the Deputy National Coordinator of Uganda's Prevention of Trafficking in Persons Department. She has advised all Ugandans to thoroughly investigate the promised jobs abroad. She adds that it is very expensive to track exploited workers workers, especially those who were illegally employed, and to bring them home.
Because now you have to send maybe people to do investigations abroad. You have to do air ticket, contracted a disease, those movements. Travel documents may have been taken away from them. So it is more expensive. That's why we are saying that before you go, you rather remain poor. You know, they're saying poverty is relative. You can think that you're poor here, and yet it is worse off there because of exploitation.
According to available statistics, there are close to 65,000 Ugandans working in UAE and the Middle East. Most work as housemaids, waiters, waitresses, security guards, and drivers. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. For Yahya Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis. We are closing out our show now due to an emergency in the building.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. Also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.